We've just returned from a city council closed session, and I'll check in with our city attorney. Is there anything to report?
There is no reportable action.
Thank you. So we will go ahead and call our meeting to order. We're going to begin with a Pledge of Allegiance that would normally be led by Councilmember Barbeau. However, we have some special guests tonight. Yes. Mr. Barbeau?
Yes, we have special guests, some children in the audience, and we'd like to call upon Andrew to help to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. Please stand.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Andrew.
Excellent job. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Bilbo?
Here.
Councilmember Moreno?
Here.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie?
Here.
Mayor O'Malley?
Here.
All present.
Thank you. Next item, approval of the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion by Councilman Sturdivant and seconded by Councilwoman Moreno. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Councilmember Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Councilmember Bobo?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie?
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0.
Thank you. We have no presentations this evening, but we do have the consent calendar. There are two items. Rather than polling item two, I'd like to have our city clerk, maybe city manager, give a little background on item number two.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm very happy to present to you tonight for confirmation Casey Bryson as the candidate for fire chief for the city of Atascadero. Casey has been with the city, I'm looking through, since July of 1994. We did a nationwide search, not one time, but two times, and Casey came out as the top candidate after this very exhaustive search. And we're very happy to, I'm very happy to be recommending for his approval or his confirmation to you tonight.
Very good, thank you. So with our consent calendar, is there any member of the public or a member of the council would like to pull that for further discussion? Otherwise, we can deal with the consent calendar by one motion. Seeing no one pulling an item, I'd entertain a motion.
I'll move for approval of the consent calendar.
Second.
I have a motion by Councilman Barbeau, seconded by Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Barbeau?
Yes.
Councilmember Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie?
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
And congratulations, Chief. Now we have updates from the city manager.
Thank you, Mayor. The first thing I want to talk about tonight is Slider Day on Traffic Way. So this downtown event held on Traffic Way last Saturday was a great hit. These events seem to be getting bigger and better each time. A lot of fun to go to. It has evolved from last year's Tater Day to this year's Slider Day, which will now be a regular March event for the Traffic Way collaboration team. Everybody enjoyed Cocktail Shorty, the band that was playing at Grape Encounters, and solo guitarist Jeff Pine, who was playing at the Carlton. There was terrific vendor participation, and sliders were provided by Biblos Mediterranean Grill, which is really good, by the way. If you haven't tried it, go try it. They're right there in Traffic Way. Back Porch Bakery, another amazing restaurant we have here in town. Marston's 101, Streetside Ale, Crush Catering, and Micro Barbecue. You can see why it was an amazing event. There were 200 tickets sold this year, and there were well over 200 people at the event. The Back Porch Bakery won the prize for the best slider, beating Marston's 101 out by just two votes. Slider Day was very successful in bringing a lot of people into the downtown, and a portion of the Traffic Way Collaborative's proceeds will go to the Atascadero Printery Foundation. Another happy news, the Bronze Tiger is back at home. On Saturday, we held a welcome home party for the Bronze Tiger at the Charles Paddock Zoo, which included cake, an official toast with foam mimosas, and a ribbon cutting. After 25 years of being a beloved feature near the front of the zoo, the Bronze Tiger statue left its post last November in order to get a face looked and makeover. While he was gone, the tiger went through a thorough cleaning process, which included an industrial strength sandblasting. His stripes were painted black, and the statue was then varnished, detailed, and made ready to return home. We're very happy to have him back at his usual post in the flamingo enclosures. And although we got him back, there's still a little bit of fundraising that we need in order to finish paying the foundry. So any donations to help pay for the tiger cleaning project are being accepted at the zoo, or checks mailed to the friends of the zoo so that we can finish this project out. But we're very glad the foundry was nice enough to send him back home where he belongs as they wait for final payment. We have a new event coming up this Saturday. It will be held Saturday, March 18th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. in the Sunken Gardens. This event is making its debut in Atascadero. However, this is the third annual Z-Day California Car Show. This is a car show that's been previously held very successfully in Pismo Beach. The event was brought to our attention by Mayor O'Malley and has been in the planning stages for over a year. Our success in bringing the event to Atascadero is the result of a lot of hard work and being able to offer more room, more flexibility, and the downtown setting that they were looking for. It's estimated that Z-Day Car Show will bring over 1,000 people from all around the state of California to see the variety of Z cars on display. The show will have Nissan and Datsun Z cars from all generations, plus trophies, food trucks, music, racing simulators, vendors, models, music, plus special guest, three-time Formula Drift champion Chris Forsberg. So we're very excited to have the Z car event right here in Atascadero this weekend. And that is from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. while we're coming out. We'll have the Downtown Art and Wine Tour. It will be held in downtown Atascadero on Friday, March 24th, from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. Tickets are $15 per person, which includes a wine glass and wine tastings at many of our downtown merchants, plus tours of historic City Hall. Tickets will be available beginning at 5 p.m. on Friday. They will be sold at two locations, here at City Hall and at the corner of El Camino Real and Entrada. And this Art and Wine Tour event is presented by the Atascadero Chamber of Commerce and the City of Atascadero. So this is very exciting news. I'm not sure everybody's heard, but we're extremely pleased that the Atascadero Farmers Market is coming back to the Sunken Gardens. As someone who can never get away during the daytime to go shop, I'm excited that it's coming here. The move from the current Smart and Final location will take place on Wednesday, April 5th. And moving forward after April 5th, it will be held at the Sunken Gardens every Wednesday from 3 to 6 p.m. There will be a grand opening celebration on April 5th with food trucks and entertainment to welcome everyone back to the downtown location. Busy parents may find the downtown location very convenient, as families have the advantage of stopping for fresh dinner items as they pick up their children from school. The return to the Sunken Garden is a welcome addition for our downtown merchants and restaurant, and the farmers market will continue to be at its current location at Smart and Final through March 29th. So please, please come out on April 5th. That's Wednesday from 3 to 6. We're going to have a fantastic party welcoming them back, and please enjoy the new location. I know we're all looking forward to having them here near City Hall. We have a conservation celebration coming up on Saturday, April 8th from 10 to 2 p.m. This party for the planet will highlight workshops geared for adults on topics like beekeeping, food waste recycling, and water conservation. Everyone will be able to check out the newly renovated demonstration garden at the Pavilion on the Lake to see sustainable plants and practices in use. And you can recycle small electronics, too. The kids will be able to enjoy the zoo, animal charades, education station, face painting, and much more. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any council questions? Very good report. Thank you. We'll move on to community forum, which is an opportunity for any of you to speak to any of us on any topic not on the agenda. And since it's a light agenda, that could be darn near anything. But we are very excited to see our world-class soccer team here tonight. And let's hear what's been going on with these folks. I'm not sure if that mic is working there. Let's see.
Okay.
Very good.
Hello, test. Oh, okay. Thank you. I am just here and a very proud soccer parent to present to you our Atascadero AYSO All-Star U12 soccer boys team. They have made Atascadero history, if you haven't read already, in the Atascadero newspaper. And this is something we're extremely proud of, and as a city, we should definitely be. These boys have come together to start just a rec team, regular AYSO season, to move on to advance and conquer the county, and move on to our Western Regional, or move on to our Section 10 championships last month in Bakersfield, and took first place to represent the state of California and go up against three other teams from Washington, Oregon, and Nevada in Carson City, Nevada, coming up on March 26th. So we couldn't be more proud, and I just wanted to say this has been a fantastic experience for the boys. The reason this group of boys, I believe, is so special is because of their positive attitudes, their hard work, their incredible coaching. We have three very wonderful coaches, Joe Subia, Matt Miranda, and Doug Martin. And these boys represent what Atascadero is really about. It's coming together. It's a diverse group of boys from all different schools. They come together and they support each other. They've had very positive attitudes in competitive coaching and sports environments. It's very easy to put a lot of pressure on one another, but they support each other, they lift each other. And this is just an example of what hard work is. So we want to thank our sponsors who've helped us get here so far. Miner's Ace Hardware let us have a wonderful barbecue last weekend that helped us raise almost $1,000 towards our goal of getting to Nevada. We have an upcoming dinner at Carl's Jr. on Thursday night to raise money as well. But we also have a GoFundMe page, and if anyone would like to donate to help our boys, we are, again, a rec team. We pay $80 to start the season and no other expected costs. So this is a surprise to us and an honor to us, which we will definitely do. But we do need to get our team of 14 boys to Carson City, Nevada, two nights hotel room, a drive, and and our tournament. So thank you all. If any of the boys would like to come up and say anything about their season and their accomplishment, I'd welcome that.
Tell them what you're proud about.
I'm proud that we won.
That's about it.
I'm so glad because we had little hope because we were up against bigger areas and somehow we pulled it off and won. So, yeah.
I think it was pretty cool that our team or our area got first and second at that tournament.
I'll just close by letting you know the reason that I think this is more exciting than just making Atascadero history is because this is a true underdog story. We are a very small player pool to pull from. We're a community of less than 30,000, and we go up against cities of 50,000 or so. Not to mention going up against San Luis Obispo A team every year is always our biggest challenge. And for the first time this year, we came right on out and we beat them, which, you know, bolstered our spirits. That was a really big, exciting thing and a shock to everyone else, including ourselves. And I think it just propelled us forward to work harder and keep training and keep our synergy going. So here's to Western Regionals and hopefully Nationals. Thank you.
Very good. Well, before you get too far away, though, could you tell us a little bit about how we find that GoFundMe point? And could you get, like, some kind of a, I think you have a press release with contact. If you could get that to us, I'm sure we can get it on our city website, and we will make sure. I think one trip to Kiwanis and one trip to Rotary, and you ought to pretty much be able to take care of that.
That would be wonderful. We did post it up here on the website, up here on the screen, to if you go to www.gofundme.com/Atascadero-allstars-boys-U12. And anything is appreciated. We've had some very generous donations already. Every penny helps. And again, join us for Carl's Jr. dinner night and visit our GoFundMe page. But thank you. Thanks for your support, too. You know,
absolutely.
It does take a village just to get kids to soccer practice. So thank you.
Thank you. Well, if we could make sure that at least council gets a copy of this flyer and we'll follow up. Very nice. Thank you. Well, that's a tough act to follow. Anyone else have a public comment for community forum tonight? Anybody else win a state championship? No? Okay. Well, we're happy to hear from anyone else, too. You don't have to be as famous as our soccer team. Okay. Well, thank you all for coming out tonight and sharing that very rewarding story. Good job. Bye. Well, we'll close community forum then and move on to the next item on our agenda, which is a public hearing on the 2016 California Building Code updates. And we'll ask our Community Development Director, Phil Dunsmore, to take it away.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. Back at you tonight with this code amendment that we introduced to you at our previous hearing. Again, tonight we'll be looking at amendments to both Title IV and Title VIII, that's the public safety text of the code and the building code. And again, primarily why we're here tonight is the state enacted amendments that run every 3 years and were officially adopted into the system on January 1st of this year. Had to turn on the clicker. A little background again. As you know, these are updated on a 3-year cycle. Last time we went through this exercise was in 2013. We're back at it again. And generally, there's two components to the building code update. There's what's mandated by the state, and there's what we have some discretion on in terms of local amendments. Now, we've had local amendments in our code probably from day one, that respond to either climatic conditions, geographical conditions, and other unique situations for Atascadero. And we'll be discussing both those components tonight. Also wanted to remind everyone tonight what we mentioned previously is any application we receive for a construction permit after January 1st of this year does need to correspond to the 2016 building code, whether or not we adopt this tonight. This is kind of acting on its own. It's just moving forward. I wasn't ready for that yet. So tonight we're going to be talking about both the basic code amendments and some clarification that we put in place after really thoroughly evaluating a large portion of our code. And also tonight I do have two empty chairs, one chair on either side of me, because I like to surround myself with professionals, those individuals that actually deal with the code much more than myself and those that interpret the code. So we've got Tom Peterson, our fire marshal, Dave Muehlhausen, our building official. They're going to come up right now and join me here. I'm going to try and embarrass them in front of the huge crowds we have tonight. They love public speaking, so I thought I'd bring them along. And one of the first items we're going to talk about is the Title IV, and that's the fire code amendments. And what we're going to focus on specifically is some of the local amendments. And again, reminder, we have local amendments that are already in effect, such as the fire sprinklers and a few other components. Tonight, we are contemplating the addition of one more clarification. And I'm going to hand this over to Tom right now to talk about the clarification of this particular item. or in this case, we'll have our chief talk about it. And if we need to, we can go into further detail with Tom.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. I'm going to go ahead and start, and then if I need help from our technical specialist here, our fire marshal, I'll turn it over, but I'm going to get started here. So we have our fire code. The fire department has reviewed Chapter 7 of Title 4 of the fire code for consistency with the newly adopted 2016 California Building Code. The CBC adopts the 2015 International Fire Code as its code. As a part of this review, the fire department is proposing to carry over all local amendments that were approved with the previous 2013 California Business Code, local modifications, and any clarifications we had at that point by the City Council in 2013. As you know, local jurisdictions can make local modifications to the new state codes, provided the modifications are at least as restrictive as the state mandated codes, and then codified by ordinance based on findings. The majority of these modifications and clarifications have been in place both on since 2010 and 2013. I think we're headed here.
You can talk about the bills. We can talk about the bills.
So we have several of these local amendments necessary to protect the life and safety of the public. It's the intent of all fire code to protect public safety. However, certain state codes do not fully consider all aspects of life safety in practical daily application. Therefore, local clarification is warranted. A couple of these modifications include that you've seen tonight, the reorganization of the fire sprinkler section for clarification purposes only, the elimination of a couple previous local amendments that are no longer applicable. They're now addressed in the state code. And then we want to maintain the requirements of previous code cycles for a flow switch and local fire bell on residential fire sprinklers. The previous code adoption is silent on this requirement for the local bell on the NFPA 13D or residential, and that it's due to its being silent, we want to add it into the code. Basically, we feel it is a life safety issue. I have a couple pictures here up on the screen. We're proposing this modification because it is a life safety issue. All homes are required by code to have smoke detectors that would notify the occupants in the event of a fire. However, the smoke detectors are not required in all areas, such as garages in the house. If a sprinkler head were to activate as a result of a fire and be overwhelmed, if the fire got out of control, the sprinklers weren't able to control it, there is a chance that the occupant would not be notified of this fire. And as the picture shows, walking into a garage with a well-involved fire could be a life safety issue. This bell ensures a notification of the activation of a sprinkler head within the residence. It also has a side benefit is if there is an accidental activation, should the occupant be away from the residence and the sprinkler goes off, this would reduce the amount of damage. Hopefully a neighbor would hear the bell and would be able to stop that damage at that point. So those are the modifications. At our last council meeting, staff was directed to show the difference in sprinkler requirements between what the California Fire Code says and the Tasker Municipal Code. I have a couple of slides here showing these differences. This first slide covers residential. As you can see, that example, that top one, number one, all new homes require sprinklers. So nothing new in Atascadero there in addition to the fire code. The second example shows that an addition under 3,000 square foot would not trigger fire sprinklers in either the state or Atascadero. Third and fourth examples trigger sprinklers for Atascadero. First of all would be any addition of 10%, and then getting to 3,000 square feet, any addition over 5,000 square feet. This next slide is for business and mercantile. There's a few differences here. The first one is that we would require sprinklers at the 500 square foot mark on any new businesses. Examples 3 and 4 show where the state requires those. The 12,000 square foot or a three-story building for a business or mercantile for the state. And if it's an example 4 there, if it's storing mattresses, it would be at 5,000 square feet. Obviously, here in Tasker, we would have already triggered those at the 500 mark. There are a couple more examples. I'm going to move over to assembly. These are occupancies used for gatherings of people for social functions, restaurants, those types of things. Anything over 5,000 square feet would be triggered for sprinklers in Atascadero. There are some triggers for the state. We have, if their occupancy is over 100 plus people, and that the square footage would be upwards of 12,000 for those A1, A3, and A4s. So basically, we're at the 5,000 mark again on assembly. So there's a few more examples there. I'm going to go ahead and leave it at that, and we can come back for any questions. The last piece that I did want to address, though, is there was a question at our last council meeting regarding a doorway between a garage and a residence. And we do have in the building code, not the fire code, but the building code, it does clarify that you do need a fire door, a 20-minute fire-rated door, unless you do have sprinklers in both the garage and the residence. So if you're going from a garage into the residence, you can have just a regular door, but it needs to be self-closing and self-latching. So that fire door only is reduced to self-closing and self-latching if there are sprinklers in both the garage and the residence. So I hope that clarifies that. And I will pass off the mic unless there are any questions now.
Yes, I think we're going to have a few questions. So, and let me begin by saying that we've, as a council, have tended to be very conservative and not adding any additional rules to the state of California, because the state of California does such a good job of giving us quite a few. Now, we have made an exception in the past when it comes to fire safety, and I personally remember being convinced by our former Chief Stone on the very issue of sprinklers and how there's never been a loss of life in a residence, I believe, where there's been residential sprinklers, and that says a lot to me. And I certainly agree with the points that staff have made, that given our situation where we are minimal staffing, we are spread out, we have a tougher time on response times given our terrain, and that I think taking some extra precautions I've certainly supported. So I think one thing, and I want to say where I am at this point, since I've already accepted this, previous councils have accepted some additions, I think it's fair that the community understands we've differentiated that we don't normally support adding additional rules, but we have in the past in this case, because we do see it as a life safety issue in our community. And so we would need to hear why we wouldn't want to continue that is one issue. Now, what I want to be careful tonight on is I'm not entirely clear of which items are just state, which are addition to the state, which are going to continue but that have been accepted in the past. Now, some went away because some of the things we added, the state has added, and so we don't need that. But there's some things we have in our code that wasn't required by the state that we added on in the past, and that's continuing. And then there's a category of things that weren't required by the state or us in the past, and we're looking at adding those. And that's the category I want to make sure council's clear on. So could you kind of differentiate there a little bit, especially with anything that we haven't added on before that might be actually new, not only to the state, but also new to our city?
Mr. Mayor, thank you for the question. Clarification is this code cycle, the only thing that we are adding that is different from past code cycles is the bell and the flow switch on 13D systems. That is the only thing.
Except for the items that we'll be talking about in just a few moments on the building code.
Yes, now, separate.
In reference to the fire code.
Yeah. Yes. Well, we won't hold the chief and the fire marshal to too much responsibility on that. But I think I thank you for that clarification. So when council asks questions, make sure we're clear on that category too, so we don't confuse ourselves. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and go to council questions. First, we have...
Now, there are additional parts to this presentation, unless you want to talk about questions with just the fire code. I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah, I think I'd like to go ahead with... We have quite a few questions by council just on the fire code. So I think it would be good to resolve that one first and then move on to the next category. So first I have Councilman Fonzi, followed by Councilman Burbeau.
Thank you. A quick question. This would be for the planning director. We can make these changes if they're justified by climatic, topographic, or geological conditions. Which one would this be for the fire code?
That would be probably all three of those. It's really in response to the fact that we have a city that is very diverse in its topographic features. A lot of hills, a lot of mountains, and we have a climate that has a really hot, dry summer where we have high potential for wildfires. So you combine those two things with properties that are difficult to access because of slope and curvy roads, difficult to get to in a very timely manner no matter how big your fire or how efficient your fire team is. You combine that with the fire weather systems that we have here, it fits really that criteria perfectly. We have a recipe for potential disaster in our community, and that's why we need to look at these things very carefully and be able to plan for, you know, potential disaster and be able to respond to an issue in time.
Okay, thank you. And a question regarding the fire bell. This would be applicable only if there would be an attached garage, correct? Would that be the structure you're mainly worried about?
No, this would actually be on all what are called 13 NFPA 13D systems, which are residential systems. The state of California requires new sprinkler systems throughout all new residential homes, and this is just...
I understand that, not to interrupt you, but your example showed a garage, and they opened the door, and there was a fire because it wasn't sprinklered, correct?
No.
So your main concern is those unsprinklered structures that are attachments?
Correct. Well, what happens with the attached garages and what the chief was referring to is smoke detectors are not required in garages. Some of the justification for removing the bell and alarms or the flow switch on the sprinkler systems was houses are equipped with smoke detectors for notification. The problem is when you have an attached garage, there's no smoke detector in the garage to notify the occupants. If they do have a sprinkler head activation within the garage, the occupants would not be notified. They could potentially walk into a door, as you saw in the photograph. On the other side of that door would be a fully involved garage. What we're asking to do is keep the flow switch and the bell on the 13D systems so there is some type of notification that there's a fire in there.
So if there is a sprinkler system in every garage on new construction...
Correct.
Wouldn't the sprinkler system go off so the person would know that's in the house, you know, they'd be wet?
Well, okay.
Correct.
So here's kind of the misnomer about fire sprinklers. Fire sprinklers only activate one head or the head that's been activated by the heat. They would not go off anywhere else in the residence. So, for example, if we had a fire in the club room back there, it would activate that sprinkler head back there only, and none of these would go off.
Okay, so if the house had a detached garage or no garage, could we exempt them without having any safety issues, from your opinion?
In my opinion, there's still areas within the house that don't require smoke detectors that can be closed off, game rooms, things of that nature, that are not sleeping areas. That could have a potential for fire without notification.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Councilman Burbeau, followed by Councilman Moreno.
Okay. Thank you. If you could back up a slide, maybe two, I think it's that one. I'm sorry, it was the business one. And, you know, I understood that the only... new change we're making is we're keeping the bell requirement. I get that. You know, as the new guy, my question to you and to the city manager had been what, where did we require additional things? So I thank you for this slide, and thank you and the city manager for the time you spent with me this morning going over this. I just wanted to clarify on the number three on this, number two, rather, on this list, where the we require sprinklers in any new business over 500 square feet, new business structure, I guess. The state does not require that until, I think this morning you said anywhere from 2,500 up to 12,000 square feet, depending on the nature of and category of the building. And so that's a pretty substantial difference, so that in a business structure that doesn't fall into any other special category, it would have to be 12,000 square feet before the state would require a sprinkler. Is that correct?
That's correct, depending upon the fire department's ability to get the water flow necessary for that square footage.
Okay. And I understood water flow was, or fire flow was a new term to me, and that essentially is our ability in terms of equipment and manpower to fight the fire.
That's correct.
And so part of the rationale is that sprinklers basically give you more time to...
Well, they also reduce the fire flow requirement.
Right.
Correct.
Okay. Because, I mean, that distinction, that large of a distinction, was something I was a little uncomfortable with in terms of us requiring that at such a small level compared to what the state required. But I appreciate the explanation you gave me this morning, and also the potential impact on the citywide ISO rating, which would reduce insurance costs for all of our residents. So I think you've addressed my major concern. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Councilwoman Moreno.
Regarding the bell, I'm curious, would it be less costly and even, you know, more widespread life-saving potentially if we simply had a requirement for a fire alarm in garages?
Through doing a little research after Councilmember Barbeau's question, went out and I've researched this in the past also, a fire bell and a fire flow switch is minimal cost compared to an alarm system.
I didn't mean alarm, but I mean detector, sorry.
Oh, smoke detectors?
Detector.
Okay, so.
Yeah, I mean, those are, you know, $20 or something plus or minus, but we're talking, you know, 10 times or more that for the bell. And then I was thinking more widespread throughout the city, why isn't there just simply a requirement for a garage to have a fire, a smoke detector, you know, in terms of if life-saving in the garage and opening a door and that kind of thing is an issue.
Yeah, that's a great question. In garages, smoke detectors don't really work well because of the amount of dust that takes place. They activate by dust and particulates, so we run into problems there, and that's why the building code doesn't require them in garages.
You haven't seen my clean garage.
False activations, things of that nature.
Okay. So. Thank you.
And with that, I would assume a smoke detector, though it's a very irritating sound if you're next to it. If it's on the other side of a door, it may not be as noticeable in terms of my impression, of at least if I'm looking at that picture. These bells would be larger and on the exterior, because you mentioned neighbors could hear it.
That's correct. Well, excuse me. One other added benefit to that is if you have a situation where a family is away from the residence and something happens, that is an additional notification to neighbors that something is going on inside the house also.
And as your experience, I mean, my impression would be you're more likely to have a problem in a garage where maybe you've got, you know, more things that might be flammable or water heaters or different things than in other aspects of the house.
And absolutely. Great question. And ironically, the areas within homes and garages, that those are the areas that don't require smoke detectors, are kitchens and garages. You don't have smoke detectors in those locations, but you do have sprinkler heads that can activate. And the bell and the flow switch provide you that notification of those activations.
Mr. Mayor, I would add that those outside sprinkler alarms make great bird nesting habitat as well.
Yeah, excellent.
They can.
Which I assume I should knock out at the proper time of year.
Yes, so, okay. Definitely.
Thank you.
Do you have any other observations you'd like to offer? Now we've heard about Ms. Moreno's housekeeping, and now we've heard about your housekeeping. So we'll keep that in mind. Thank you. Very good. Any other council questions? What I would like to do, and I'm going to kind of look over at the city attorney, since to me this is divided up into draft ordinance A, dealing with public safety fire code, and draft ordinance B, dealing with building code, I'd kind of like to deal with these separately, at least kind of get a consensus that we're done with this aspect and then move on to the next, in which case I would go ahead and open up public comment twice, one on each one, and potentially even have a motion to, okay, we are going to go with these in separate. Would that be permissible, Mr. City Attorney?
Yes, you can vote on them separately, and if you wish to take public comment separately, okay, you can do that as well.
So I'm going to go ahead and do that, and then we can kind of...
Just one moment. Apologize.
Go ahead.
We do have some corrections to the ordinance that is the fire ordinance that is in there. So yeah, if we could skip to those slides really quick before public comment so people know what they're...
Yes, now, and let me check in with Phil, because if I'm making it more complicated for you, I'm trying to keep it clear for us, but would that be easy to do, to just deal with all the fire-related stuff related to draft ordinance A and then move on, or do you have it integrated, it's going to be easier to just keep moving?
You're on the right track. You're absolutely right. You can do it that way. I just have to be able to show you some edits that we have here that are part of that code before you proceed to take action
okay
on it.
Well, let's go ahead with it, since I didn't have any overwhelming objection. Let's go ahead with all the fire-related stuff, so I'd entertain a motion on the draft ordinance A after we go to public comment and come back. So go ahead.
Thank you. On page 25 of your staff report, under that ordinance, the draft ordinance A, after publication, we did note that there are a couple things that we wanted to revise. And one of those is in the section 903.2 on that page 25, and it's item number 4. There is a section there that is actually crossed out. We actually meant to leave that in, and it's the words throughout an existing building other than a. And then in the next section, section 5, we added some additional wording for clarification and eliminated item number 6 because it already covers that in that clarification that we're proposing. And that speaks to the very item that we were speaking about earlier, which is the clarification on when sprinklers are triggered at that 3,000 square foot level. So we have some proposed language that just really spells that out. It doesn't change the meaning of it. It just more adequately clarifies when that occurs. And that's in that line A on number 5.
And I just want to clarify line A. It probably should read, and total combined floor area will exceed 3,000 square feet. I think we're in a hurry. It's not that the additions exceed 3,000 square feet.
Okay. Do we have a question on that one? If I could take a question, Councilwoman Moreno.
I thought the way I read it was that if you had a 3,000 square foot and then you had a 10% addition, that's what triggered it. But what you're saying is if you have a 10% addition and with the addition it's 3,000 or more, that's what triggers the requirement?
Let's have the professionals chime in on this. We were talking about this a lot today, and it is confusing.
Yeah, with the existing residential sprinkler systems, the last code cycle, that would have been true. Any 10% addition would have triggered something, would have triggered sprinklers. Now, this last code cycle 3 years ago, we brought that up to 3,000 square feet because we didn't want to be overly restrictive in the aspect of people doing modest additions to their home. We wanted to give them some leeway and not have to impact them with sprinklers. So we moved that up to the 3,000 square foot level. Any addition to a house that is remains under 3,000 square feet does not require sprinklers. So it can be 20%, it can be 50%. If you have a 1,000 square foot home and you wanted to add 1,000 square feet, it would not trigger sprinklers. Or if you wanted to add 2,000 square feet, that would be 3,000 foot would be the trigger. Then at 3,000 square feet, if you add 10%, that would be the trigger point for sprinklers. All the way up to 5,000, where pretty much any addition would trigger sprinklers.
And so then if you were, so this particular 10% and 3,000 means that let's say you're at, you know, 2,700 square feet, or let's say 2,750, you add, you know, 10%, that takes you just over the 3,000, that's what would trigger it.
Correct.
But if you're at 2,700 square feet and you do a 10% of 270, or even go to 299, that doesn't matter, you're still under the 3,000, so it's the 10%. So what if you were at 2,900 and all you did was add 200 square feet? It puts you over the 3,000, but that's not 10%, so you still don't meet this requirement, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Very good.
Thank you.
Boy, are you sharp tonight. Yeah. All right. Councilman Barbeau.
Okay. On this particular slide, though, I'm a little confused then. I understand that explanation. It would seem to answer what you talk about relative to number five on this slide. But number four, if perhaps I'm misreading it, but it seems to say almost the same thing, but that it would apply if you went over 2,000 square feet.
Now, keep in mind, it says throughout an existing building other than an R3, so other than a residence.
Okay, so these are the... Okay. Okay. And the other question I had related to this is, have you compared our requirements with other cities in the sense of, you know, particularly the other cities in San Luis Obispo County?
Multiple times in multiple years.
And are we being more restrictive or the same, more or less, or...
I would say we're about mid-road. There's some that are more restrictive, and there's some that are less restrictive.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I almost hate to touch it because there are so many questions I have about which percentage applies when. But let me ask, let's say you are, I've got a few hypotheticals just to help me think this through. So... One, you're going to, let's say you have, if I am understanding this correctly, you've got something short of 3,000 square feet, and you're going to add something that's going to basically trigger that. And when you go, whatever you add then, does that just mean the additional part has to be sprinkled, or does the entire retrofit the whole building to be sprinkled?
Correct. It would be retrofitting the entire structure with the new addition also.
And would it not even matter, let's say, if whatever you were adding was basically fireproof? It's concrete block. There's nothing burnable. Much like our basement here that's solid concrete, and we still have sprinklers, which is a mystery. But...
Unfortunately, the structure itself may be fire-resistive or fireproof in some instances, as people like to describe concrete. I have seen concrete burn. But
we got other problems in that case.
Then. Exactly. But it's the contents that we load into that building. So there's a lot of what we call live load that is combustible that will definitely burn, regardless of what we make the structure of. We seem to always introduce a lot of flammable items into that structure.
That's a good point. And then the other question would be, let's say that same scenario, and you're going to, you're adding on an addition, but the existing structure is not maybe structurally adequate to handle the load of pipes full of water running through, and is that then would that then kick over to your counterpart Dave that you might then have to do some structural reinforcement in order to accommodate? Is that
most of the time in residential sprinklers, we're not going to find a situation because we use what's called CPVC piping in the industry now. and it's very lightweight plastic or chlorinated polyvinyl chloride, and very lightweight, water weight only, and they're typically only, you know, an inch to inch and a half. Most of the residential systems have 3/4-inch pipe, which really don't put a lot of weight on the structure itself.
Let me ask our chief building inspector question then. In your experience, have you seen very many cases where that would be an issue, or do you, as the fire marshal said, in most places where you're something like that triggered with an existing home, for example, or a business, maybe it's different?
No, Mr. Mayor. In a residence, the loads aren't going to be that much on a residential system. In a commercial structure, that would be, that might be different if they use cast pipe, iron, whatever. So then that would be in the engineering package that's submitted for review.
Okay. Are there other council questions? Councilwoman Fonzie.
Just a clarification. So if someone had a residence that was 2,000 square feet and they wanted to build an accessory unit, a granny flat, a second unit, would that be lumped into the total, or would that be considered separate and not applicable?
And you're referring to a detached second unit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's ironically, the state just changed that code this year. If the primary structure is sprinklered, then the second unit would have to be sprinklered. If the primary unit is not sprinklered, then the second unit, whether it's new or not, would not have to be sprinklered.
Interesting. Thank you.
Councilmember Burbeau.
I'm sorry, that just prompted a question for me then, because having built a second residence with a, you know, with an unsprinklered primary house, we had to sprinkler the second house. I thought, though, that we as a city have long required, not long, maybe for several years now, have required sprinklers in all residential construction, regardless of their status as primary, secondary, what have you.
Correct. And this Senate bill caught all of us in the fire industry off guard a little bit. We didn't know where it came from, but basically it was to try and allow more second units in. I don't know how it impacted the building industry, but the Senate bill specifically states we cannot create a local ordinance to override the state requirement saying that these second units will be sprinklered.
And so, to make sure I understand, this is a Senate bill, or was this passed?
It's been passed.
Okay. And it's, so it's not addressed in here in this new, this three-year iteration of the code at this time?
It's in the code.
Oh, it is? Okay.
It's in the California Fire Code, not our local code.
Wow. But so that's a very substantial change from your perspective, I assume.
Correct. I don't know what the percentages would be that we would be looking at for second units. We see a fair amount. But typically it's where we have newer existing structures that are sprinklered, and then they're going to be required sprinklers anyways.
Okay. So, I mean, I can say from it's very expensive. It can be very expensive to put in sprinklers in a second unit, up to requiring redoing your entire water supply from the street, as well as some other features, you know. Tens of thousands of dollars, so this would be a significant money saver for somebody putting in a second residential unit, but it might be of concern to you from a safety perspective.
Correct, and we always try and work with the property owners on finding the least expensive way to allow them to do that. We do have an understanding with our water company that if we provide a letter to the property owner, that they will waive the cost of a meter upgrade and allow them to tap right into the residential, which is what we do, to run a line straight over to the new second unit.
That would work now, but where you would require sprinklers, it requires a higher flow and might require a larger pipe, not just a larger meter.
Every circumstance is different.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Okay, that's a pretty substantial change then, or so. Thank you.
Any other council questions? Any other information to present to council regarding draft ordinance A?
No, thank you.
I'm going to open up the public. We're just getting input on draft ordinance A, Title IV, Public Safety Fire Code Amendments, and then I'll ask council for a motion on that, then we'll go forward with the rest of the building code. So any member of the public wishing to comment on this item? Seeing no one approach, we'll close public comment and bring it back to council. And as I say, I'm inclined to support staff's recommendation, quite a few changes. But again, I will stick with, I think, a matter of public safety. That is our number one priority. And I think I appreciate that our staff are by nature pretty frugal and also understand council is wanting to be very limiting and adding extra rules. But I am convinced, as I have been before, that this is truly a benefit to the community for public safety. I often realize that one of the issues that sometimes you look at someone making these kind of requirements in a community, and it may not be that first call that's an issue, it's that second call. We have a lot of roads that prevent fire trucks from maneuvering very quickly or going to a second call, and that really jeopardizes everyone else in town with limited resources. So anything we can do as a community and as a homeowner to make our residents more safe, and I think it's kind of a sustainable issue for our community to just be safer. So I can support this, and with that, I'm going to move we adopt staff's recommendation with the corrections. Is there a second?
Mr. Mayor, I'll second. I did have a comment, though, about ex parte on this. I had spoken to the Home Builders Association about this and asked them if they had concerns on this and or the next portion of the agenda, and spoke to some folks in commercial building about, you know, whether or not these imposed a undue burden on them, and I did. They didn't, you know, choose to speak or choose to comment on the staff report. So, I believe it's acceptable.
Very good. Well, you correctly pointed out to me that this is something that does require ex parte. I'm usually better at catching that. So, I'm going to take a step back, and I'm going to restate is if any other council members have had any ex parte, that's again where we hear anything outside of the public process that might influence our decisions. We need to disclose that really before taking a vote. And because I missed that, I'm going to reopen public comment. We're going to hold that motion for a moment. And any other ex parte from any other council member? Since there was, I'm going to reopen public comment. So there was some input to council outside of this public process. And so if any other member of the public would like to comment on that before we vote, I would entertain that. And seeing no one come forward, I'll close that public comment. We do have a motion and a second on the floor. I'll ask for a roll call.
Really quick, I just need to read the title of the ordinance.
Thank you.
An ordinance of the City Council of the City of Atascadero, California, repealing and replacing Chapter 7 Fire Code of Title 4 Public Safety Code of the Atascadero Municipal Code. Councilmember Robo?
Yes.
Councilmember Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie?
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Thank you. Well, we'll move on to that draft ordinance B. Turn it back over to you, Mr. Dunsmore.
Thank you, Mayor. Yes, on to the second phase of our discussion, the building code amendments. And you know, we do also want to discuss a few local amendments tonight. Also want to remind you of just kind of sort of what a complex process this has been. Over here against the wall behind me, I'm not sure if you can see this cart. That is what we're talking about tonight. Those are all the codes that we're dealing with and automatically adopting. If you can see that big cart, I had Dave wheel that cart up here, not for the big first impact of impression of it, but just in case we had to reference some sections that are in there. So I do want to apologize to you that there's been a little back and forth on some last-minute amendments and some tweaks here and there, And a lot of those amendments aren't really things that we're trying to add additional things to, but we're really trying to clarify it for how they work with our local code. And so some of the amendments I'm going to talk about right now, which are local amendments, are just that. They're clarifications so that we can more easily interpret the code for the city of Atascadero. And first of all, what I'm going to tell you is these are just a few of the notable changes that the state has put in place. One of those is a maximum height for accessory structures has gone up a little bit. And there is a couple different reasons for that. As part of that is also associated with secondary dwelling units. I think there's really a lot of pushes for making more flexibility and less restriction on that. Another one is something that's known as the tiny house rule, and that reduces the habitable floor area, the minimum floor area in a structure. Previously, that was set at, what was that, Dave, 120 square feet. Now it's down to 70 square feet. So that's pretty small. That's one of those things that we can't say much to it. That's what the state's doing right now. Another one there is also requiring that in commercial and multifamily projects that they are pre-wired for electrical vehicle charging stations. Doesn't mean they have to put the station in, but that they put the wiring infrastructure underground for that. So those are just a couple of the notable items that we've seen in the code. There's dozens of other ones, but they really aren't very significant things. They're just little tweaks here and there. Now, on our side, on our local amendments, and our building official can speak, you know, probably into more detail if we have questions on these, but I'm just going to run through these because these are some of the things that we did note in our report and we did note in the ordinance. And that's one of them is the adoption of the 2015 International Pool Code. And that's one of those things that fits into that category of, hey, this is a clarification. This gives us a toolbox to work with as an instruction guide to help people out. It's not something that adds an additional barrier or additional burden on someone installing a pool. And the same goes for the international solar energy provisions. Those two portions of the international code are really helpful. I think your microphone is off there.
Yeah, I had kind of underlined every item on that, and maybe when you go through those, you could give a little more explanation of what that's talking about, because I was curious just exactly what has changed. How would that affect a resident of Atascadero with this change in the swimming pool and space code? And each of these, maybe a little more detail on what does that mean to us?
Yeah, we can do that. Let me actually have Dave chime in right now on just those two items of the international codes on both solar energy and the pool code, if I may.
Thanks.
All right, so the 2015 International Pool Code, Swimming Pool and Spa Code. It's a requirement out of the residential code that you refer to that for the installation of pools, spas, and hot tubs at a residential property. It'll also help us. The building code is gray on commercial swimming pools. You have to get a lot of information from the health and safety code. And what this book does, it puts everything together. It takes the requirements from the mechanical, plumbing, electrical codes, puts them into one book. It makes it easier for us to be able to plan check, to answer people's questions, and then if we can refer them to purchase this book, we're all on the same page. So it simplifies things.
So if I'm understanding what you're saying there, that on these by topic, we aren't really adding additional rules as much as there's rules in multiple categories, and we're kind of doing it a topical summary, like pulling a page out of each of those different books there, and if you want to know about swimming pools, here it is, and likewise on solar. So that sounds like that's streamlining. So that sounds like a good thing.
Yeah, it really is, and that's the pool code. And then as far as the international solar energy provision, this is more, again, a reference document. It takes the ICC rules, standards 100, 300, 600, NFPA 70, the I-codes for solar energy, and again, puts it all together into one book. Where I really like about this book is that it discusses solar thermal and auxiliary systems. So we're doing great with our PV systems. So this will help us head in the direction of helping people do solar systems for water heating, which I think is coming up in the future. They're making it so the panels now are about 12 by 12 for a water heater on your roof. And this book will help us understand that better, understand the requirements for that, along with the manufacturer's installation instructions. And it'll help us train the or teach the citizens, how to, make this happen. And
very
again,
good.
This is just for reference.
Okay, well, that helped me understand that a lot better. Thank you. Continue on.
All right. And then there's the section about another clarification section on what's exempt. And this is a question we get just about every day, and what's exempt from a construction permit. For example, a little structure less than 120 square feet, yada, yada, yada. There's a few of those. We really wanted to have that list right there in the code rather than going to the cart. Building Code Appeals Board. There's a little bit of clarification here, too. I think previously there was some interesting stuff about the council doing that and who does that, and I think we've clarified that here. And then the next one there is the ability to review EV solar installations digitally. Is that solar or electric vehicle? Isn't that supposed to be PV review digitally, photovoltaics?
Yes, we do.
Or is that supposed to be electric? It's not supposed to be EV. That's a typo on the slide. Is that right? Where
no,
it says
we'll
EV?
We'll be doing electrical vehicles over the
charging stations.
Yes.
Okay.
We'll be
just
doing
wanted
those,
to clarify.
Yeah, electronically.
Okay. And then lastly, repealing and replacing the water efficient landscape ordinance and replacing that with the state ordinance, which the state ordinance is already out there. Ours was sort of going a different direction, was inconsistent with that. So it just is another reference point to have that right in the code. So in conclusion, there's the mandatory amendments with the building code, and there's local amendments and clarifications we want to add. I do want to mention that we didn't do this in a vacuum whatsoever. We did a lot of outreach with the community in terms of the folks that are doing the construction. This was brought to a number of the chapter meetings and discussions that Dave does. We also made the code available, and we asked questions about these local amendments and how people felt about them. Is there an issue? And we're trying to educate about all those issues. So it was something we've been talking about since last year, since we knew these amendments were coming forward, and we began talking about how can we make some clarifications and some local amendments. Again, just like the fire code, there is a couple things that we need to clarify. There is an omission that I really want to make note of that's on page 37 of the staff report in the ordinance, in the draft ordinance B. And there's a section that got left in there as an addition where it really wasn't meant to be added in there. It wasn't originally in the code. We had it proposed to be added. Now we're proposing to take it back out. And that's the 105.1.2 on page 37 that talks about occupancy and who does that occupancy inspection. Not necessary. That is already in the California Building Code, and it's in there more eloquently than we had it worded. So not necessary to have there. Just wanted to clarify that. And there's one more item, and this is on page 52 of the staff report. There's a section 8-4.101B, and the wording that's struck out there is proposed to be replaced with the wording below it on the slide there. That's what it should have said. Adopt select selections, sections of Chapter 1, Division 1, Chapter 1, Division 2, as outlined in the matrix adoption table of the California Residential Code. The wording above was a leftover from previous and did not get edited properly. Again, I will leave you with a recommendation. This is the item number 2 on this list, to introduce draft ordinance B for first reading as proposed for amendment by staff with those previous slides. And that is by title only, and that would repeal and replace Title 8 California Building Code and adding those local amendments. And at this point, I'm available to answer your questions.
Thank you. And before we go to council questions, since I neglected to bring that up before, I want to just check in if there's any ex parte on this area of discussion. I would
Home Builders Association on this.
Yeah, that's very good. Thank you. Any council questions? Go ahead.
Good report and clarification on one of the slides. You had mentioned about the electric vehicle, having to have the electric vehicle ready, you know, wired ready for installation. On the slide, it did not say single-family homes. In our staff report, it does. So I just wanted to get a clarification on that.
We are talking about single-family homes. And it's not something that I don't believe it's required that they be wired for that. It's just that we can review that digitally.
Okay. Thank you.
Could you expand on what that means? I wasn't clear when I heard that discussion a little earlier, but it does sound like, at first it sounded like we're requiring that you have an electrical charging station in every garage or something, but what do you mean you can review it digitally?
Not the case. So basically, someone can email us a submittal.
Okay.
And we can look at that, really trying to streamline the process. And eventually, we'd like to have a lot more things go that way, and perhaps with our new permit tracking system, that will evolve over time. But this is one of those processes where it's either an over-the-counter or, even better yet, an email submission where we can look at that digitally.
Okay. Thank you. Well, let me, we got a follow-up question by Councilman Sturdivant.
I just want to clarify, because actually what it states here is a requirement that new single-family duplexes and attached units are electric vehicle ready or pre-wired for installation. That's the statement in the staff report. So it doesn't say about an application. It says it's a requirement.
So, Phil, I think there are two parts. The state code has changed, requiring that they're now ready for all single-family duplexes and attached units. And then we're proposing a local amendment to allow digital submittals for those things. So there are two different parts. And I thank you for that
clarification. So, yeah, that goes back to this slide where I mentioned before that for commercial and multifamily or attached units, they do have to be pre-wired for it. This is a separate item here about allowing those to be submitted digitally. So, thank you.
So if we could go back to that previous slide, because that's what caught my attention, is ready wiring for commercial and multifamily, but not single family.
Page 18 of the staff report at the bottom does say new single family duplexes and attached units.
So it's not intended to be single family, but a duplex. I shouldn't really say single family, because a duplex is not considered a single family residential unit, even though it may be under separate single ownership as a condominium or a planned development. And I'm looking to Dave here just to correct me if I'm not being accurate. So a single-family residence like we have in our RS zone that's on its own lot, that's not attached to anything else, would be exempt. Now, an attached duplex that may be privately or separately owned is subject to that, the way I understand that. And so apologize for the in the report.
And this is a state requirement in any case. It's not a local requirement.
That's correct.
Okay, so even if we had an opinion, it doesn't matter particularly. So I understand that. Okay. Okay, I think we do have several council questions. I'm going to go by the lights. Next one up is Councilmember Burbeau, followed by Councilwoman Fonzie.
And before we get to my question, to be clear, though, the way it's worded on page 18 says single family. And so if that's not correct, then that needs to be changed.
It's not correct that it's single family. Okay. It's only attached units.
Got it.
So apologize for that language. We're going to... I think it looks like Dave's going to the cart.
Well, I'll go to my actual question. When we talk about the submission, the electronic submission of the plans for solar and electric vehicles, I guess it didn't dawn on me that how the plans are submitted are I guess actually part of our code, but that kind of procedural stuff, it seems to me, could change over time as, you know, more and more things become digital and there's more and more, it's easier and easier to do that. Wouldn't you just have the ability at some point in time to accept, you know, an accessory structure, a barn set of plans electronically? Is this something that needs to be in the code or in our municipal code, or can you just adapt as, you know, as systems and procedures change?
You know, it may continue to evolve. And in 3 years, we'll be back here again looking at these same things. Every 3 years, we're going to be doing this.
Okay.
So I think we're just trying to keep moving with the times.
Okay. I guess I didn't know why that would require necessary council approval for you to accept electronic versions of
it. I think it's just us wanting to add a clarification to the code rather than a mandate or anything else like that.
I'd like to see us, you know, be moving forward to make things easier for plan submitters.
Absolutely.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilwoman Fonzi.
Okay. I just want a clarification because I'm getting confused. This is getting a little complex. So if something is zoned commercial or the actual use is commercial and zoned multifamily, or it could be a single family home with a structure that they put in as a second unit, would be considered multifamily.
So it's actually the actual construction. It's not the zoning. So the zoning in terms of our general plan and zoning doesn't affect it. So if someone builds, if they're allowed to, in certain cases they are, a single family residential unit in a commercial zone, that wouldn't be applicable. If they built a single family unit in a multifamily zone, which happens all the time, that's not applicable. So it's based on an attached residential unit or a commercial venture.
So let's flip that over. You have your single family home and you build a second unit for grandma. Would you have to do it?
Now, secondary dwelling units aren't considered multifamily. So not the way I would interpret that, but that might be subject to other interpretation.
No, that would not require you to install the underground for an electric vehicle. We might recommend it to the property owner, but
just want to be really clear. Thank you.
Right.
Well, on that note, let's say you have a single-family residence pre-existing. It's on a piece of property that's zoned multiple units, and you then go ahead and add on and basically convert it to a triplex. And so you're basically adding two housing units on to an existing housing unit. Would this then, kind of like sprinklers, mean you'd have to retrofit the initial, or would it just apply to the two new ones? Just a picky one, but I'm trying to understand.
Basically, then you are multifamily, so then you'd have to run a wire underground in your parking area in one or more locations, and I'm not sure of the volume of number of units we'd have to be prepared for, but it would be simple as running a wire that's ready to be plugged into, at some point, a charging station. So it's with this requirement, it's pretty simple. That's not anything near as difficult as doing a whole sprinkler system in a house. It's running the electrical.
This is wiring ready. It doesn't necessarily mean a whole charging unit.
And that's correct.
And we address this to the chief building inspector as soon as I have everyone's attention over here on our end of the spectrum, that this is really, this is not anything extravagant in terms of it's 110 or 220 or something. It's not some unknown new thing. We're just going to have a conduit with a wire coming through it that's tied to a breaker box somehow or another, and you don't even necessarily have to have whatever it is you're putting there, or is it really just a standard plug-in?
It's a conduit that's buried, or we've had a couple of submittals where someone has added it to their apartment unit, and it's a conduit that runs out to a box. They plug into the box, and it's a very simple process.
Okay. So it's just basically getting something like an outlet close to the car.
Basically, that's it. And, yeah. Okay. And the junction box that it attaches to. UL listed, and away we go.
Very good. Any other council questions? Well, I will open it up to the public. Any member of the public wishing to comment on any of these items? Seeing none approach, we'll close public comment, bring it back to council. Have we been fully instructed on every nuance now? We're prepared to deliberate, nothing else to tell us?
You have 99% confidence, yes. No, 99.9. I think it's great.
You mean you're not entirely confident of the council, Mr. Director? Okay.
Oh, no, I'm confident of you. I'm just I'm looking at myself, looking
okay.
back at myself.
Very good.
And that big cart back there. But, yes, no, you're...
We'll let it go. Thank you. Council, deliberation, motion?
I'm happy to make a motion if you could put the... Actually, it's right here in front of me. I move that we introduce draft ordinance B for first reading by title only, repealing Title 8 building regulations and replacing Title 8 to adopt and amend the latest editions of the construction and fire codes and adopt findings of facts 2 for consistency with the 2016 California Building Code.
I'll second that with the staff recommended changes added.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Ms. City Clerk, is that adequate motion or do you need to do something to it?
No, that works. I just need to read the title.
Go ahead.
Okay. An ordinance of the City Council of the City of Atascadero, California, repealing Title 8 building regulations and replacing Title 8 to adopt and amend the latest additions of the construction and fire codes and adopt findings of facts to support the imposition of requirements greater than the requirements established by or pursuant to the California Building Standards Code.
Thank you. So we have a motion by Councilwoman Moreno, seconded by Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Councilmember Bobo?
Yes.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie?
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Thank you. And Ms. City Manager, my compliments to all of your staff. I was expecting this to be much harder than it was, and I think staff was very well prepared, and I'm glad to have our fire marshal and chief building inspector here tonight, and it was very clear and helpful for us and got a few things that we gained some understanding on, I believe. So thank each and every one of you. We'll move on to the next item on the agenda, which is public hearing B2, CDBG final recommendations, and that'll be led by Mr. Nick DeBar, our Public Works Director.
Thank you, Mayor O'Malley. Tonight we have the final recommendations for the CDBG block grant program. Back in December, the City Council looked at a draft recommendations and made those for this. This is usually the time we make a final recommendation to be forwarded on to the county for funding. Typically that is available next year or later this year for projects that would occur next year. So that, as I mentioned, back in December 13th, draft recommendations were made. There's approximately $154,788 is the estimated amount that's going to be available. Unlike previous years, we don't have final numbers from the county for whatever reason. Not really the county, I should say HUD. Typically, we have those numbers at this meeting. We don't, so we'll have to make a recommendation based on those estimates and then, you know, however you want to handle it, maybe proportionally prorate those amounts with the final numbers. Also on top of the $154,788 is this reallocation of the Morro Bay's CDBG monies for this year. Last year, we had some fund balances from projects that weren't done, and much like, I guess, one of those would be the Atascadero Lake Park project for the irrigation and some of those ADA improvements that we just felt like, you know, that's probably not the best use of the money given that we're in a drought and, you know, why by really, you know, put in irrigation systems when we don't want to use water and we're trying to cut back. And really that mulch out there is handling up good. It's kind of in a higher traffic area. So, you know, it was kind of fun balance from that and other projects that we had completed. So this is, I believe it's 4 years they're repaying the loan back. It was $200,000+. So this year's first payment repayment is $75,563. And of that amount, the county likes to take a part of that for administration. This was allocated prior. These were monies before they changed up that 20% that they take for allocate, or I guess it'd be 20% of the allocation for admin cost. They changed it up in 2015, so they're kind of going retroactively and taking that amount out for the administration cost. So it's just something that we kind of made an argument with them about it, or if we're successful, we will be able to put that into infrastructure, not into admin costs. But I don't think we'll, I'm not hopeful about being successful with them. And then also there's some fund balance. I'm not sure if anybody's noticed the latest CDBG project that was completed in front of the ASH along El Camino Real. We did a sidewalk infill project, and that actually pricing came in great. We have some unexpended funds in there that we can reallocate to another project. These are infrastructure monies, so they need to be spent on infrastructure cost. So we're pretty close to the end of the project. There's still like a final payment to make, but costs are pretty well set, but there's a little over $40,000 left. We're leaving a little bit in there, and we can reallocate that in a future point to another project, but we're comfortable allocating $40,000 of that project of unexpended monies towards another project. And right now our project that we're going to be working on this summer is short money. It kind of a scope creep from actually getting out there and getting surveying. This is the Atascadero Mall project, where if you go underneath the tunnel and come out over there by ABC Church, there's going to be a walkway that you'll be able to take immediately to the right and then be able to cross over to the north side of the mall. And there's an infill sidewalk over there too. Well, a lot of that sidewalk along that side of the mall needs to be replaced because the cross slope is exceeds that 2%. Then, so anytime it's contiguous to a project, you need to make those improvements. So that's what staff is going to be recommending tonight for that unexpended money. So here's the spreadsheet with the council draft recommendations and then a suggested recommendation from staff. A couple things to note here. The public facilities piece, initially we had included that Morro Bay amount of $65,000 with the traffic way. Well, given the fact that we're running short on this year's project, we're suggesting that maybe that Morro Bay money be reallocated to this year's project to cover the additional cost that we're going to be incurring on that project. So that's that first two rows there under public facilities. That's kind of the difference. Same amount. It's just broken out in that way. And then public services, not really knowing at the time what other cities were going to be allocating or recommending to these other organizations. We do have the draft recommendations for these other cities in the county. Unfortunately, Lowe's and Fish's did not have any other recommendations for allocations. So to meet, actually get the grant, the county, again, back in 2015, I shouldn't say the county, the HUD changed up a little bit, needs to have a minimum $8,000 grant, so that 6632 would not cut that. So we're suggesting maybe that get bumped up to 8,000 because they don't have any other monies that they were awarded. The city of Atascadero, that 8,800, we would recommend going to 8,000 on that one. And that amount, that 800 from that would be applied to ECHO to kind of bump that up, because ECHO would be the one that would, we would suggest maybe taking that additional money to make sure Atascadero Loaves and Fishes has a grant available to them. Now, the other thing with ECHO is that Paso Robles awarded ECHO $9,189, and the county also awarded ECHO $50,704 for a total of $59,893. So ECHO is getting other monies from the county and Paso Robles, and that's kind of our basis of this logic of maybe, you know, taking some money from ECHO, giving a little bit more to Atascadero Loaves and Fishes, so they have a grant there. And then the administration, as I mentioned, that actually went up $9,000 and some odd dollars. Just we didn't include that administration cost, so that was kind of left out of the last one. And at the bottom there, that reallocation from the unexpended monies from the South El Camino Real infill project in front of ASH, we would suggest reallocating that to the Atascadero Mall sidewalk infill project. So here's the Atascadero Mall infill project. As I mentioned, the north is, I guess, towards the top of the page here. The tunnel is actually on the bottom right portion of the picture there. ABC Church is on the bottom. Ardea Avenue is on the upper right. So it's kind of hard to see in this picture, but we're going to actually add a sidewalk immediately after you come out of the tunnel to the right. There'll be like a 12-inch high barrier curb, so if anybody's seen that guardrail over there, it's pretty beat up. And I know the maintenance guys have replaced that a number of times and bent it back into shape and done other things too. So having a 12-inch high barrier curb there is important. And then also getting that over to that crosswalk across Ardea there, and having a stop, there'll be a stop condition there just because of the blind intersection. Now, this is not ideal. The city did receive a complaint from a resident on this block that I'm pretty sure the council is aware of, and this was the solution that was proposed and accepted by Caltrans and the FHWA in a resolution with that voluntary compliance agreement, is what we call it. The initial recommendation, or I guess request, was for a mid-block crosswalk on the mall here. We had already been planning and made adjustments for some projects to have an improvement at the bottom of the high school entrance, fill in that gap of sidewalk about mid-block on the north side, plus get a nicer crossing. So, you know, if you're walking from ECHO and going down Atascadero Avenue, it'd be a nice crossing there. The students would have updated ped ramps and everything else. But this was the design, I guess, or the concept that was agreed upon, that, you know, acceptable to all parties. And then this would be the Traffic Way El Camino project. Now, this one's going to be pretty substantial. The money that would be proposed or allocated to this project would not cover the entire cost, so this would at least get surveying going. We'd get plans and specs and then have a balance for construction, but next year I would recommend that any fund balance would be proposed to this project. This is basically in front of the auto repair shop on the northwest corner. Next time you drive by there, take a good look at that. The cross slope on the sidewalk is very steep. It's basically a driveway apron. And you know, there is some connectivity underneath the Highway 101 tunnel. There's a sidewalk there already. And then along El Camino as well, next to that, it's kind of an auto sales place too, the lot there. It's very steep and very much out of compliance, so we want to fix this one up too. It would also include fixing up some of the sidewalk on the south side of Traffic Way as well, directly across from the auto sales lot, the southwest corner. The northwest corner and the northeast corner and the southeast corner are currently in good shape, and we're redone with the streetscaping project. So the recommendation tonight, which is a slightly different from the staff report, is to review and approve the funding recommendations for the 2017 block grant program, which also includes that repayment from Morro Bay for their 2017 monies, and then reallocate $40,000 from the 2015 South El Camino Real project to the 2016 Atascadero Mall sidewalk infill project. And I do have the spreadsheet, and I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to work this or not, but okay. I guess with that, that concludes my report, and I can take any questions you have.
Well, first, let me do my usual complaint about the county overhead and a 50% increase this time, so just duly noted. I assume there's not much can be done about that. And I don't think I have any question about the public services portion. I've always been an advocate for doing ADA improvements. We've done very good in our city. I'm a little concerned about some of these because normally in a project we have a lot more discussion with council, and this seems to have been progressing on with other things going on, and council did not get a chance to weigh in because we usually have been so supportive of ADA improvements. We'd rather do a better job than a temporary fixed job, and I think in a couple of these situations, it's feeling a little bit more like that, and you know that may be unfortunate, and we might want to consider. I don't know if there's some alternatives. I don't know what the time frame is with the CDBG. There seems to be some potential to maybe shift that around future of changing priorities, because maybe we might use the CDBG for other ADA accessible projects and then use other city funds for some of these. But I think council would have liked to have been more involved in some of these ideas, because I think we put a lot of effort in from the whole access off of Highway 41, even rerouting safe routes to schools. We had a master plan that was really pretty well thought out in terms of connecting multiple schools, the downtown. We've got the North County Christian School, the Bible Church. There was a lot of thought given into how do we make that hub, and working around a couple of bridges and really doing a pretty nice job. And this is seeming like we may accommodate an immediate felt need, but it's not as nice of a project for our community. Are you telling us that basically we don't have an option?
The accommodation, if we're talking about the Atascadero Mall sidewalk infill, was a accommodation based on a Department of Justice complaint that the city received. And so therefore it had to move up to the top of the priority list per the Department of Justice, regardless of the fact that some of our other projects would accommodate more people, pretty much our hands were tied by the feds on this one. The other one at the high school is still a priority. We are still looking for funding. We still think that that will be a good improvement, and we'll continue to work on that one. This one, we were given a very short time frame to get this accommodation done.
So is liability waived for the city of producing a less than ideal solution as opposed to the one we had worked on?
No, the Department of Justice would not waive liability.
I knew the answer, but I just thought I'd hear it. Thank you. We have a few council questions. First, Councilman Burbeau, followed by Councilman Sturdivant, followed by Councilman Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie.
Yes, my question, the Morro Bay reallocation, I just want to make sure that we don't get double charged by the county, although it wouldn't surprise me if they do it, in the sense that they charged overhead when we moved it to Morro Bay, and now they're going to charge their overhead as it comes back in four incremental payments.
And that's what we're going to check with them on. I'm not sure what Morro Bay, if you're concerned about the county double dipping, basically.
Yes.
From Morro Bay and then from us.
Correct.
And we are too, and we're double checking on that.
Because obviously, I mean, we fronted our allocation to Morro Bay with the understanding we would receive it back in full. And if we're receiving it back in less than full, it means that us and other jurisdictions likewise aren't going to do that kind of trade-off anymore.
Right, and one of the things with that money that they're repaying, it was money that we had, say, allocated at a 2012 project, for instance, that, you know, they didn't have that separate admin cost, so they're kind of taking it out because they would have already from that, you know, previously. So we're kind of working through that with them. And
okay,
like I said, I'm not real hopeful that we're going to win that argument, but we're going to try.
Got it. Okay, and I was thinking this was maybe a too much in the weeds question, but the mayor said the council likes to get involved in these projects. So if you could go to the pictures of the traffic way El Camino in front of the car, yeah, that one is good enough. So you're talking about in this upper picture making that a sidewalk along where all those cars, the front ends of all those cars are?
Correct. Okay. There is a sidewalk right now there.
Well, but as you refer to it, it's really more of a long driveway apron at a, you know, steeper slope than a sidewalk.
Correct.
So my question is, you turn it into more of a classic sidewalk, are they going to be driving these cars off the curb? Because I imagine they're going to still, as long as this pre-existing non-conforming use is there, they're going to be displaying cars.
Right. We did go and meet with the owner there and went over this, you know, what we can do, and we're still talking with him. We're still going to, you know, try to allow and work with him to be able to use that as is. And I think there is a solution that we can work out and still meet the ADA requirements for cross slope.
Okay. Be interesting to see what that is, because I just visualize him driving over the curb.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I think you might be able to have a little lip on the end there, but, you know, obviously if it's a low car to the ground, you know, we certainly don't want it scraping on the bottom of the car either.
No. Yeah, no Z cars, as Councilwoman Moreno says. You're very good. Well, along with that, though, this is another situation where it's a ADA requirement. It is a sidewalk. Just because people are using it for something else, it's usually pedestrians are given precedent, and you discussed or you're considering maybe there's, normally you'd have like one egress, maybe two ingress, egress. Maybe there's something that they can use to kind of put down to move cars up and down with. It seems like it's always going to be a safety issue because you've got cars going across the sidewalk. That's where pedestrians go. And literally, you could have five cars exiting, T-boning in along to it. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Now, I understand it's a pre-existing use, but it seems like there's a lot of liability for the company practicing driving over a pedestrian right-of-way. But you're dealing with that, and you think you've got a solution.
We think we have a solution. You know, we ran it by the property owner there, kind of thinking about it a little bit more. It was a few months ago we met, and there was some driveway approaches and, you know, interior to that site, too, we maybe suggested. Because if you look up there, there's actually a service station island with a canopy. And so it's not, you know, it's kind of using that site in a different way than what it was is really kind of designed
intended.
For right now. But he was very amenable to any improvements we were doing and obviously concerned too. But I think he felt like he was willing to work with the city on trying to remedy the situation.
Well, normally it would be the property owner's responsibility, actually, if this is commercial property and there was going to be upgraded, the property owner would have to install all this ADA-accessible walking sidewalks, and the city's basically going to replace it all at the city's cost. So that's quite a benefit for the commercial property owner that I imagine that's $40,000 plus.
That's correct.
Very good. Okay, we have Councilman Fonzi followed by Councilwoman Moreno. Questions?
Yes, a question regarding the south side on Traffic Way, what I would call the gone property. Since there's going to be La Plaza developing in that area, is it possible that they would take out what you put in, or they could do it on their dime rather than ours, and we could use the money for something else?
That's correct. So more recently, we've been meeting with the developer for the La Plaza project. This particular property would be like a phase two, so it probably wouldn't go with the first phase. But I would agree we would probably hold off and make sure that whatever they end up doing there doesn't undo what we just did. So it's. I was going to comment, too, at the bottom of the high school entrance there at that five-legged intersection at the Tescanero Mall, I know the school district is really looking at doing some improvements over there as well. So we it's probably an opportunity to pause that project to make sure we coordinate, you know, whatever we're doing with the school district. And Stu Stoddard over there, I've had a number of conversations with the last couple of weeks about maybe getting together and kind of working with the school district on not just that location, but other locations around the schools and crosswalks and safe school zones and safe routes to school program.
Very good. And a question regarding the Atascadero Mall. It's going to cross across, and then we're going to be paving. I thought it was dirt over to the tunnel. Is that correct?
No, that would be a paved.
It would be paved, and
correct.
That's part of the cost.
Correct.
Thank you.
And that would be all in the city right away. So there's a fence that goes along there that is real near Caltrans right away, but we'll be doing all that work within our right away.
Yes, thank you. So two questions. One, regarding the crosswalk, and the mayor asked about the liability, do we have in writing from DOJ what we need to, like, just say, hey, we were made to do this? So the extent we have some backup, I hate to say when something happens. I don't mean to be pessimistic. But do we have everything, whether it's through talking through CJPIA, getting what we need from DOJ, so that we have, to the extent we possibly can, protected ourselves from liability?
You know, as I mentioned, they actually thought the mid-block crosswalk was a good idea, which we all kind of shuddered at.
Right.
Just knowing what mid-block crosswalks are. And so we made this other pitch to have it on this end because it wasn't so much, it's the most direct accessible route for the one individual is basically what it came down to. So it wasn't, you know, a mid-block crosswalk or something down on this end of the mall was the only option that they were going to accept. And the mid-block crosswalk was a very scary idea to us, and we didn't feel like it was safe at all. And we felt this was a safer option. It's not ideal, but it is a safer option. There's liability in anything.
So by choosing a safer option, are we actually taking on more liability because DOJ says that wasn't our idea? We wanted a mid-block crosswalk. I'm just trying to get at, is there any protection for us whatsoever for this? What we're being forced to do here.
In talking with CJPIA and talking with our attorneys, the answer is no. There is no protection from us. We can't pass the buck to Department of Justice. That being said, they can be pulled into a lawsuit,
right?
Just like us.
And we have it in writing from them? Because initially it was just verbally, and we had said we want it in writing.
We have as much documentation as we can. Obviously, they haven't put, we're telling you to put it. They say you have to come up with a solution, but it's got to be a direct route to that, and it's your responsibility to make it as safe as possible.
And that is in writing. And we have stuff from FEMA in writing, but we know how that's gone.
We pushed for as much as we could get in writing.
Because if it's not in writing, it didn't happen, right? So
right.
Then
no,
why
I mean,
would we do anything unless it is in writing?
So we do have the emails and all of that regarding this, and the letters from Department of Justice on that. It's not as clear as all of us would like, and it's certainly not as clear as I know, you know, you would like. We pushed for as much as we could get. They are the feds. They do have the... they get to rule.
And one of the things, too, I might just piggyback on what Rochelle's mentioning. We had a lot of conversations with them, a lot of conference calls over the course of a couple months. And, you know, we asked, what if we don't do this? You know, we don't agree to do anything. I mean, then they said they'd come back and they'd probably make us do this whole, not only this, you know, mid-block, but maybe this one and the other side of the mall, too, at the bottom of the high school. So they would say, oh, you have two areas that are non-compliant. Now you have to do all this work. So even though we still planned on doing that work at the bottom of the high school, you know, we just didn't have the money, funds right now to do all that with CDBG. So we wanted to use CDBG monies to do this work. So
I guess from that perspective, I mean, there's probably in any city across the United States, there are things that aren't ADA compliant. As much as we'd like them to be, they just, you know, from day one weren't. And so, you know, things get put in place and entities do what they can when they've got the money. And of course, the sooner the better when you have the funds. But from that perspective, then what stops DOJ from just sending everybody a letter about every single place in town that isn't? I mean, isn't there some grandfathering? Otherwise, literally, they could come in and say, spend $500 million to fix everything. They could actually do that.
And that kind of happened up in Paso Robles a few years back where, you know, they had to spend millions and millions of dollars to upgrade all their accessible ramps and because they had some lawsuits and other complaints against them, and they were forced to do that. So we're trying to do it in a controlled manner, not be just right. Have to do all these improvements, but try to phase them in when money's available.
Of course. Well, and I appreciate that you have found what is, you know, potentially a safer option. So, you know, at least we're able to work for that. Regarding the payback from Morro Bay, so there's obviously the double dip question, but if there's no, I mean, when did the county start charging that percent? Wasn't that just 1 or 2 years ago? So
20,
I'm wondering.
2015.
Okay, so 2015, but the money we gave to Morro, or loan to Morro Bay was in 2012?
We made an agreement to kind of clean up a lot of our unexpended fund balances from projects, and they were doing a bigger project, I think the Embarcadero project, which required front-loading that with money they didn't have. So we borrowed some money to them, and they're repaying it back in future CDBG allocations. So I'm not super familiar with what happened prior to 2015, how they got their cut, let's say, if it was part of just a project or if they had separate.
But the county didn't used to get a cut, right? That 2015, that was
do you
new.
Remember?
That is correct.
Manager.
The county did not get a cut of previous allocations. And I think we should also look as to you know, in theory, if they are getting their cut because it's a Morro Bay 2015 project.
Morro Bay needs to pay us for the county fees.
That I think,
or pay the county the fees. Yes. That's exactly what needs to happen.
Is that the inquiry you'd like us to make?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Thank you.
We will do that.
Thank you.
Any other council questions?
Yes, Mr. Mayor, I'm sorry. I thought there were questions on the other end. Okay. On that picture in the, you know, suboptimal, not desirable, but safer than the crazy idea crosswalk, you know, having made that turn a million times, I'm sure most of us have, and you see the beat up guardrail, I'm a little confused where actually this sidewalk along that chain link fence is going to be placed, you know, because cars are running into the guardrail, obviously concerned is going to run into the sidewalk. But is the sidewalk going to be like behind where the guardrail is now? And so, which it seems that the guardrail is really close to the fence, at least when you drive by.
Correct.
And you're saying the fence is on our city right away. It's not on Caltrans property. So we can actually build the sidewalk inside of that, of the, where the guardrail is now?
Correct. So we'll take the guardrail out, and there'll be a 6-foot wide sidewalk that'll be pushed up against that fence, roughly. And that's a Caltrans fence.
Okay.
And then, I don't know if you can look up on the screen behind you. I've got a laser pointer, or I guess Luca's doing this too, but this inside island there would have to be cut out a little bit.
Oh, okay, to make the turn wider.
Correct, just gotcha. To give some turning movement.
Got it, thank you.
Any other council questions? You know, I don't believe we've opened it up to the public yet, so I will open up to public. Any public input on CDBG? Welcome.
Hello, I'm Tim Eccles from Atascadero Loaves and Fishes. For 5 years, I was their grant writer. I'm transitioning those responsibilities and assuming the president of the longest-serving, continuous-serving nonprofit to this city, 32-plus years. We serve between 400 and 600 families each month, families or households. That amounted to about 230,000 pounds of food last year. We anticipate more weight in food as we've improved our procurement of the most requested items, which are meat and fresh produce. But I'm here to comment on the CDBG process and give you a little bit of history. I do appreciate the restoration of the minimum threshold of $8,000, but let me take you back in history as to what Atascadero Loaves and Fishes has accomplished with CDBG. In 1997, CDBG funding purchased one of the two business condominiums that we occupy as our food pantry currently. Up until 2011, the county provided typically an equal share with the Atascadero City towards Loaves and Fishes. And after 2011, that was removed. And since then, we've been dependent only on the share from Atascadero City. In one of those years with Atascadero City in 2014, we received $5,068. On that same year was the second direct audit by the county at our food pantry, requiring a significant amount of time. We are an all-volunteer staff. The reporting for a CDBG grant amounts to approximately, and this is conservative, 60 hours of work for $8,000. Our data person is at the pantry sometimes before 6 a.m. I see him as I'm driving to the gym. He is the one that is responsible for much of dealing with the data that CDBG requests, which includes quarterly reporting of our ethnic and demographics, then something called a HUD desktop monitoring, which basically accounts for all the different types of postings and requirements and bilingual staffing that we must have to satisfy HUD requirements. And then there's the final report, which I've been responsible for the past 5 years. And by the way, I'm not passing on the government grants to our current grant writer. She needs to get on board, and maybe next year will she take on the rather onerous request from our federal government, both from HUD, and we also receive a FEMA grant. Our total operating budget is about $160,000 a year. So the $8,000 is 5% of that. Almost a month of our operating purchasing of food at our pantry, almost a month. Very, very appreciative of this, and I have to say that this comes after, and I must confess, my expressed disappointment with the minimum amount that we received originally at $6,600. And I also will confess that I was willing and I felt obligated to our organization to actually turn back the grant monies if we didn't make the threshold of $8,000. So I'm here to say thank you very much. We're here to serve an extreme poor income level, fixed income, those that are working poor, meaning less than minimum wage or minimum wage, and then trying to make that work for their livelihood and for their existence. So we're there every day, 5 days a week, every afternoon, providing services to people that I believe people in this very room cross paths with. I'm appreciative again for the service of the Public Works Director and rearranging and making the budget work to allow us to receive the $8,000. Can I answer any questions? One last thing. We founded the ECHO group. They are now their own autonomy. Our budget is about one-third of their budget. And their budget includes significant contribution from a county general fund, as was expressed by the Public Works Director. So, thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for years of service, and we certainly do appreciate what Loaves and Fishes has done, and we're all thankful for the community we live in that gives so much. I was just down at ECHO as Mr. Burbeau spending the night the other night, and I was Kiwanis helping with food, and as you know, there's a lot of volunteers helping with that. And what's unfortunate, I've spent my whole career really working in health and human services, managing multiple complex budgets that are equally onerous as you described for this particular one, and it is a challenge. Cities don't really receive funds for anything like this, health and human services. We have very limited funds we receive that are all categorical for roads or various things. And so we do try to stretch this little CDBG funds, which is really the only thing that allows any kind of a public service like this. And it used to be more money. It was. It's been very frustrating to the council and staff that it's such a small amount for the amount of paperwork required. We kind of hear you on that. And it is now probably just as well that they made a requirement locally that there's an $8,000 minimum, because it really is a lot of work for anything less than that. So unless an organization receives at least $8,000 across the county, they don't receive any funds at all. And so we try to, in our city, our council is always focused on local organizations. You can see here it is, Loaves and Fishes and ECHO, primarily folks, and the youth scholarships for local kids. So this is primarily focused on those that have the least ability to find resources and folks within our city. So our council has tried to focus on that as well. But We always wish there was more in this area, and we really are thankful that the community does come together so often on these areas of need. Well, here we are again with not a lot of money to hand out, and some catch-22s, and besides the federal overhead, we have some county overhead. But I think staff has done the best they can with the hand they were dealt. So thank you, staff, for that. Any discussion by council or a motion?
Well, Mr. Mayor, I should just point out from an ex parte standpoint that I'm a volunteer at Loaves and Fishes, and so I actually discussed this issue with Mr. Eccles last week during my last visit to the pantry.
Yeah. This, I believe, is one that doesn't require ex parte, I don't believe, but maybe it does for things outside of our public service, but I think it's at least it's not considered a conflict of interest if you do volunteer work with any particular organization. If I'm correct, Mr. City Attorney, you want to clarify?
No, I wasn't.
City Attorney wants to clarify this for me.
No need to clarify. You're right. There's no conflict.
But no, I wasn't revealing a conflict, but that I had a discussion with him about this issue.
At Echo. Yeah, as part of your involvement with... Okay, with Loaves and Fishes. Okay. Any other comment or discussion or motion?
I'll make a motion that we approve the funding recommendations. Hold on. Make sure I'm looking at the right page. Yeah. That we approve the funding recommendations laid out by staff as revised for our CDBG funding for 2017.
There's more on the screen.
And do we have a second?
Just reallocate the $40,000 as well. Is that good? You go with that too?
Yes, and also reallocate $40,000 from the 2015 South El Camino Real project to the 2016 Atascadero Mall sidewalk infill project.
I'll second that.
Very good. We don't have to worry about getting it too exact anymore because the city clerk is going to state it however she wants it if need be. Are we okay on that motion?
I just want to make sure that also in the original recommendation on the agenda, it said to authorize staff to proportionately fund if there's additional monies, and I just want to make sure that that's part of the motion.
I believe it is.
Yes.
It is.
Okay. All right.
So with that, a roll call, please.
Councilmember Bourbeau?
Yes.
Councilmember Sturtevant?
Yes.
Councilmember Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie?
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Thank you. Moving on, no management reports. We move on to committee reports. And then first, are there any council announcements prior to the committee reports of any council activity that a council member would like to report on? I'll go from my left to my right, then we'll come back to committee reports.
Yeah, just committee stuff.
Two announcements. I'd like to say we have the ladies' conference in Atascadero, 35th annual on Saturday. Over 400 women in attendance, mostly from throughout the county, but some from out of town. And it was fantastic. We use a lot of local vendors. We have a lot of donations. It's really run by volunteers. Councilmember Fonzie and I were both there. Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie and I were both there. And I want to thank our mayor and police chief for helping with security on Friday night and parking and all of that. So it was a really nice event. Secondly, I wanted to, this will be the last announcement before Dancing with Our Stars next week. But Dancing with Our Stars is I think most of us know it as the big library fundraiser, and this is the 8th annual, and what they've done is they've now incorporated 6 other nonprofits. And so I just want to let all of the folks know that there are still tickets available, I know for Thursday night, possibly Friday night, but atascaderodws.org. And the 7 different organizations that are fundraising through this event for our community are 1, the library, Echo, Kiwanis, which is doing a project at Santa Rosa School, I believe,
yes.
Atascadero AAUW, Atascadero Land Preservation Society, the Boys and Girls Club of North San Luis Obispo County, and the Atascadero Greyhound Foundation, which through their work with Lighthouse, what they're doing is actually bringing a mentoring program that's going to have high schoolers mentoring 6th graders. So this is really a tremendous project. The fundraising that's taking place here is amazing. And so the show is The show is wonderful. I know many of you have seen it. Frank Sanchez is the director, and it's quite the production. So if you're available, come and join in Thursday, March 23rd or Friday the 24th. Go online at atascadero.dws.org, check it out. And even if you can't go, you can donate to any one of those organizations your vote, which helps them raise money for all the different projects that they're doing. Thanks.
Thank you. Other council announcements?
Mr. Mayor, I forgot.
You forgot one. Go ahead.
I did. First of all, I did attend the Slider Day on Traffic Way event and talked to several businesses and who seemed all upbeat about the event, but also, you know, that things are looking up in general. And I would note to the city manager that had I gone back and dropped my vote off, the Back Porch Cafe would have won by 3 votes and not just 2, because it was most excellent. Also, Friday the 3rd of March, I attended the Cuesta College Foundation luncheon at the Marriott that they were hosting for District 5, because their community college board reps coincide boundary-wise with our supervisors. So I attended that. And the most interesting thing, I think, was that their efforts to expand the Promise Scholarships to include a second year for local high school graduates. That they're hoping to get that into play in the fairly near future, so that'd be a good thing for our residents.
It was quite a busy week, and of course we did attend, some of us, the special memorial for Chuck Ward held down in San Luis on last Friday, and then of course we'll have the one coming up this Saturday out at the Lake Park Zoo, the Veterans Memorial at 12:45. And Ms. Moreno and I also, of course, have to admit the chief and I were at the ladies' conference Friday night and Saturday, mainly working, but Heather did a pretty good job too as emceeing, and we did have several other events to attend simultaneously. It is always, you kind of hate to take the time to explain to folks that really want you to come to their event that, you know, I'm going to really try to be there. I'm going to try to be those other 7 events that are scheduled at the same time as well. You kind of understand why Cacho looks like he's always in motion, because he was a master at being so involved in the community. And we try, but Heather and I were able to make it to Slider Day on Traffic Way as well in time to visit with some friends and hand out the awards for the winners. So that was good participation. And there's a lot of interaction at these events, because every time I've been there, you kind of network with some of the local business owners that have an idea, and actually some of those ideas have turned into other events or other businesses. And so I remember before talking with the folks that ended up moving into FIG and had some discussion with them at a previous event downtown and helping staff to get connected. And the person with the miniature golf actually talked with him at a previous event like this downtown, and again got him together with staff and helped his plans move forward. So it's good to be involved in these community activities and interact and support each other. That's the kind of community we have. Any other announcements? We'll move on to committee reports. I'll go ahead and I'll just kind of touch on a few briefly. We did host a county mayor's roundtable. All the mayors get together once a month, and we hosted the group in Atascadero this time. And it's a good group. We actually get along pretty well for having a lot of differences. We were honored to have our State Senator Bill Monning join us, and we had quite a long discussion about state issues. Again, we always ask about transportation. I'm not very optimistic about solutions there. We've been working very hard on solutions about the recycling problem. I think there is a push for some legislation that would kind of improve on that. Folks are often surprised of how complicated this can be, because someone was saying, well, what's the problem if we're now down to less than 40% in the 30% range of the required recycling centers across the state? And if there is not a recycling center, the stores are required to provide a service or be fined $100 a day. Well, that's not too bad for a large corporation, but for a family-owned business, that's a real challenge. And people say, well, why don't the stores just do the reimbursement? That makes sense. You know, you pay money for a can and a bottle, and you're supposed to get it back when you turn your items in. And I have to point out to folks, well, the problem is that's not how we do it in California. We pay a fee that goes to the state of California, but only a recycling center can actually get reimbursed for the reimbursement. If a store takes this on because they're required to, they have to collect the fees, send them to Sacramento, but they're not eligible to get that money back. They have to pay it out of their own pocket. Now, I know that's hard to believe, but that's the situation we are in California, and that's why the recycling program is failing statewide. And there's a few other catch-22s. So we are working on legislation. Bill Monning is trying to get that to where they waive the unbelievable charging a fine to stores that refuse to basically collect money for the state. They do that, but then to provide the service really at their own cost. It just is a problem that doesn't work. So that's been a priority that we've been working on for some time. We did have a meeting with San Luis Council of Governments, Regional Transportation Authority. Things are fairly bleak there and not a lot of money to divvy up, but we continue to make some improvements in how the bus system is managed countywide, and that produces enough savings to kind of maintain service level. That's what folks are trying to do there. With the Integrated Waste Management Authority, I used to be involved with that. We had Councilman Kelly take that on for a couple of meetings, and now I'm back. And I was promptly elected vice president again because there were a lot of folks that didn't come back, and I had the most experience, so I'll go on with that. And it'll give me a position to help fight for some of these statewide reforms that we are trying to work on. So that's about it for those committee reports for me. Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie.
I just would like to bring one item to attention of the board today. The Board of Supervisors voted as the board that they will act as an agency to participate in the unincorporated areas in implementation of SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. This is something to keep an eye on. In the past, when we had a previous board with a different political tilt to it, they were saying that they would stay out of it, that would be managed by the state of California at a much greater cost. And it was almost punitive in the way that it was scheduled to be implemented. At this point, we may see special districts not being formed or formed out in the unincorporated area to implement SGMA, but it's something to keep an eye on. It will affect our operation as a city. Even though we don't provide water, we will be affected by this. So I just wanted to bring it to your attention.
Thank you. Well, Council Member Burbeau, you're actually next on the list. Any committee reports?
Yes. Tomorrow I'll be attending my first Homeless Services Oversight Council meeting, so I guess it was timely. I spent the night last night at Echo. So
yes.
Bring that experience to the table, I guess. And I noted the mayor there serving food. But I'm not sure if this is something I should bring up and ask the council as a whole about or not, but one of the items on the agenda is to discuss a letter, I guess, to the Board of Supervisors. They had their subcommittee on affordable housing, write a letter, and they're recommending four things, one of which it appears to be that to the Board of Supervisors to fully implement their affordable housing in lieu of fees. You may be aware that they had only done like 20% for a number of years, and then they've slightly modified that, but they've elected not to implement the full amount. And I don't know if it's appropriate to ask the council for your thoughts on it or not. The other recommendations were to collaborate with the Home Builders Association to discuss incentives, that sort of thing. Third was to ask the county to monitor the effects of streamlining permit application processes. And fourth was just to conduct public education regarding the merits of the county fully implementing its in lieu of affordable housing fee. So I don't know if the council, thoughts on that, or if the city attorney thinks it's appropriate for us to discuss that.
Well, let me take a stab at that. And again, more by tradition, we've given the person appointed to a advisory committee a lot of leeway to figure you know how the council thinks and encourage you to represent our entire community, our entire council. But there is a problem with us giving you direction. I think it's good to get some input if you want some ideas, but it's always tough to give someone some direction on something that then they're going to go and vote on, because you might get new information that we wouldn't be privy to. So I think you want to, I would be something that we, if there was, sometimes what I've done on a regional board where it's an issue that maybe it's more specific, like we're going to put a plastic bag ordinance on, I might suggest, well, at that regional board, I would like to have that agendized at each city's council meeting and have some discussion and then come back with something. That would be, you know, one way you could do that, and then it's more of a formal. But I'll ask our city attorney if you'd like to advise. I'm okay with continuing allowing each representative a lot of leeway in the area that they are representing with the council, and if you want some casual input now and then, that would be fine. Mr. City Attorney, a more detailed analysis on that?
No, I agree with that approach for the point you've made, which is that you don't know what's going to come up at the meeting, so you don't want to give direction to a council member who then feels obligated to follow that direction, even though they might hear something at the meeting that would suggest a different course of action is appropriate. So if there's a particular item that you wanted to have a discussion on in advance, you would need to agendize that here at the council level first, like you said on the plastic bags as an example.
Yeah. Right. And I don't think this is as significant as that or as clear as that.
Yeah. And sometimes it's even what anyone could do is if on your own initiative under council announcements or under a committee report, if there's a topic you'd like input on, you could ask the city manager to list that, and then folks know that that's going to be a topic. But I think nothing could necessarily be an action item unless it was a formal presentation, but we could cross that bridge if it comes to that.
Thank you.
Thank you. You are very conscientious, and we appreciate that.
Speaking of not feeling conscientious, however, tomorrow is the Design Review Committee meeting.
And you're ditching that?
And, well, it conflicts with the HSOC, and so we need to resolve those schedules in the future so that that doesn't happen.
Very good
especially
point.
Especially since in this one I understand that Councilmember or Mayor Pro Tem Fonzie will not be able to participate either. So.
I'm thinking if two of the members can't be there, that the council members, the city manager will have to resolve that in any case.
And I'd like to say, just to clarify, I will be there, but I have to recuse myself because I have a conflict of interest and will have to leave the room.
So anyway, we'll let staff realize that we're all, a lot of us, doing double duty, and we'll work a little harder on making sure we don't have that kind of a dual interest. Anyway, very good. That then takes us to Councilmember Moreno and then Councilmember Sturdivant.
I'll just note that the EVC, along with a couple other organizations, kind of co-sponsored a housing summit last Thursday afternoon down in San Luis Obispo. So Linda Hendy from the Chamber and I went down. And a lot of things that were very specific to more San Luis Obispo proper, so not a lot of ideas that coming out for a rural community, but it was really nice to sit next to someone from Transitions and Mental Health who said, gosh, you know, Atascadero is really the only city in our county that's really doing well with and exceeding the affordable housing requirements. So I thought that was nice for someone outside to recognize that. I'll say the one thing that did come about, there were a couple individuals from Santa Barbara
talking about what they're doing in their downtown to make things more affordable, and we might all laugh at downtown Santa Barbara being affordable, but they, you know, for them, have some ideas that could certainly be applicable to San Luis. But one of the things that came out of that, because as we talk about our downtown and the potential for mixed use, and but then we have the parking issue, and they brought up a really good point that with parking on a, you know, in a downtown, there's going to be a self-selection, meaning that if somebody has three cars and wants all these parking spaces, well, then they're not going to be living downtown because they might have one space, you know, or zero or something like that. So it was just interesting that that concept of self-selection, which obviously works in many areas, and that could work with downtown parking as we look at things in the future.
Thank you. Well, that does bring to mind one other announcement I'll make. A number of us were able to attend the People's Self-Help Housing grand opening here recently, and we all really love that program because really it is sweat equity. It's folks learning how to build their own homes, and with that sweat equity of doing a lot of the work themselves, they are getting a nice house at a much considerably lower cost. And I do want to take this opportunity to commend staff. One, I commend past councils because we've done a good job of doing development impact fees and full cost recovery and setting funds aside to help with some housing options that really other cities haven't done. And we've actually got things built by partnering with folks like Self-Help Housing. And additionally, staff have gone out of their way to see that that gets streamlined. And we had a couple of situations where because of the bad weather, here we were with a bunch of families ready to move into these homes that they've worked on. And the various circumstances, they didn't quite get their permit processing as tidied up as it really should have been. And we're going to work on that in the future. But our staff, again, went out of their way. We had lots of folks getting together, going out there on that day so that those young families could take that key and move into their house and get certified for occupancy. So, again, staff really went the extra mile. I know they're putting in a lot of their own time to make things like that work, but you do have to appreciate that. But I enjoyed not only telling folks at such an event a story about me growing up and building a house with my dad and how that feels to looking back at that, but also because of our effort with the parks grant money we received, that I could tell these folks, not only did you build your own home and you get to live there with your family, it's because of their effort and those sweat equity efforts, those families contributed us having that high compliance rate with the state of California, so we were eligible for $750,000 grants for local parks. So I attributed to those families, they helped us, our entire community, have parks for our whole community by their sweat equity too. And I think that meant a lot to them as well as the fact that they've got their own home. So it's those are the things that make being on council kind of fun, that we are doing something that makes a difference. But I do want to commend staff for their effort across the board. Any other staff announcements or reports?
I don't have any.
Oh, I'm sorry.
All right.
Councilman, I got so excited about self-help housing, and we've got League of California Cities and the activities you're involved with. Take it away.
There's no report. There's a league coming up. I have a policy committee meeting at the end of this month, so there's going to be a lot of housing issues. So it'll be
yes.
Very interesting. So I'll report back after that meeting.
And thanks for doing that state involvement. Any other staff? Well, I see the city manager is fairly tired, so I guess we should adjourn. Thank you.